Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Dealing with mental illness has many facets, but one of the most heartbreaking is the stigma that often accompanies the condition for the afflicted and their families. We'll be talking about that a little bit later. But first, sometimes the Missouri River plays second fiddle to the mighty Mississippi. The Missouri had no Mark Twain, but it did have Lewis and Clark and Daniel Boone, and is straddled by some of the most picturesque landscape in Missouri, especially in the 100 miles or so west of St. Louis. In fact, it's been called St. Louis's Grand Backyard. It's all beautifully detailed in the book, Missouri River Country, 100 Miles of Stories and Scenery from Herman to the Confluence. The text from dozens of contributors is framed by a wonderful array of art and photographs, and with us to talk about the book and its inspiration are editor, conservationist, environmentalist Dan Burkhart. He's co-founder of Magnificent Missouri and the founder of the Cady Land Trust. Patty Hagen is director of the Audubon Centers at Riverlands, and Terry Hammer is the owner of Herman Hill Bed and Breakfast, each as authored book segments. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Congratulations on the book, by the way. It's really a beautiful piece of work.
Thank you.
And as the editor, I guess most of the credit goes to you, but everyone here was involved. You all come at this from different perspectives, obviously, and I'd like to put the same basic question to each of you, and I'll start with you, Dan. How would you describe the Missouri River mystique?
Well, the Missouri River, as you said in the introduction, often is overshadowed by the Mississippi. The Mississippi is the one that gets to flow by the arch, and the Missouri is kind of out of sight, out of mind a lot of times. And it's often overshadowed by river politics. The politics of the seven states the river flows through are pretty difficult. And the times we most often hear about it are when it floods or when it misbehaves. And so what we wanted to do was really talk about the land along the river and not get bogged down in all of the problems that go along with water management on the river. Although we touch on those, several of the writers talk about those.
Yeah. Patty, how about you and your perspective on this?
Well, the Missouri River, as Dan said, is sometimes overlooked. And I think, though, what we have here is a beautiful gem of natural resources in the state of Missouri. And it's really important to connect people to those natural resources in order to create environmental stewardship and care for what we hold dear here in our state. We have so many beautiful places along the Missouri River to preserve and to actually invite people to visit, and we want to make the most of that.
Terry, last but certainly not least.
I think from Herman's perspective, it's been many things. It started out as a gateway to the West. When Lewis and Clark went up the Missouri River, it was a very shallow and wide river. It's been channelized over the years. And finally, beginning in the 1920s, bridges were put across, which again united the valley. Today, you think of how the hundreds of thousands of guests that visit the various towns like Herman are able to walk across the Missouri River over a protected hiking and biking lane and use the Cady Trail and really experience the river. It almost comes full circle from where it was when Lewis and Clark did that in the early part of the 1800s.
Do we have the Germans primarily to thank for settlement along the river? Is that a fair statement, do you think?
I think the Germans certainly preferred to be along the river, particularly on the south side of the river, because you have to remember that prior to the Civil War, Missouri was a slave state, and the British basically settled the glaciated parts to the north of what now is Interstate 70, and the Germans were vehemently anti-slave, and so by being to the south part of the river, they were somewhat protected, and their political views weren't pillaged the way the poor Germans were that lived on the north side of the river.
I had heard at one point, there's a reference in the book, that the Germans who came and settled Herman basically they came primarily from Philadelphia, that particular area.
Correct.
Did they lay the town out much in a pattern that was existent in Philadelphia at that time?
Yeah, and they had really grandiose plans. Market Street was to be several feet wider than the Market Street in Philadelphia. And they really wanted to create a German culture there. And so while they named a few streets after American presidents, most of them were named after great German cultural personages. And they really had a lot of zeal toward creating the kind of environment that would just make it a great city of the West. Mm.
Dan, you mentioned at some point in the book that the river has a boatload of problems. You alluded to some of them early on, but what are some of those problems in a little more detail?
Well, the Missouri River has always been a bone of contention because it flows through so many states. Mm-hmm. It flows through seven states. Every state wants something different from the river. I heard the governor say the other day that we didn't want the Missouri River to end up like the Colorado River, where it flows into the Pacific Ocean, because it doesn't. Mm-hmm. There's no water left. And so that's been the root of the problem, is the upper states want water for recreation and a number of other things, possibly today for energy exploration and fracking and things that go along with that. So there are all kinds of uses for the water that ends up here. We're fortunate because the water that flows by the water plant in Chesterfield in one day is sufficient for St. Louis's needs for a year. We take very little water out of the river, and obviously we'd like to see it stay that way.
Are there not similar problems with the Mississippi? It flows through several states, too. I haven't counted them up, but I'll bet there are at least seven.
The Mississippi doesn't have dams on its upper reaches, and that's the dilemma here, is that back in the 30s and before, a lot of dams were built up in the Dakotas and Montana that hold back water. And those can be controlled, and the amount of water released varied. And so it's something that's been talked about for a long time. The Post-Dispatch had major editorials on this in the 1940s. And as we were researching the book, we found a lot of material on that. So it's not a new problem. But again, the goal of this book is to talk about what's great about the Missouri River Valley. And what's great is that it makes life here in St. Louis interesting and better for all of us to have this beautiful river valley just to the west of us.
Patty, you had mentioned environmental concerns and stewardship and the rest of it early on. How well are we doing in that regard on the river?
Well, I think, you know, it's a balancing act like any environmental issue is. And, you know, there are many uses of the river. And as Dan mentioned, recreation, water supply, agriculture, natural resources are all contending for the kinds of uses that the river provides. And so it's difficult to balance these in an appropriate way, and everybody has different ideas about what the proper balance is. I think, you know, some of our challenges are to try to find the right balance and to continue to work together, because I think really all of these things come to greater issues because of everybody's love for the river for different reasons. And if we can find some common ground, we can make the river healthier over the long term.
Dan, you've lived near by the river for a long, long time. How has it changed? How long have you, and how has it changed?
I grew up in Jefferson City, and I moved to St. Louis, lived close to the river, and I've had farms along the river for 30 years. And in terms of physical appearance, there were wing dikes on the river back when I first knew it in the 60s, and they're still there. The goal of this book is really to enlighten people and to try to share our enthusiasm for the river and the river valley so that people will want to see it protected. huge swaths of the river valley west of St. Louis are undeveloped, as we point out in the book, primarily due to bush conservation area that blocked development going west along the river. And we're very fortunate that the land hasn't been degraded, that it hasn't been compromised, that it hasn't been developed. And we'd like to see discussion about that today so that that it's that way tomorrow.
And Terry, you, of course, want to see more people heading in your direction, tourists, as it were. I guess that has picked up quite a bit over the years.
It has, and we've been blessed with some major benefactors. Jim and Mary Dierberg currently are working on a living history farm and have been one of the biggest proponents of Herman and have invested not only time and talent but a lot of resources to make things very accessible for visitors. It's not uncommon for people to say as they drive from Washington to Herman that they go from 2013 back to 1950, and they like that feel of a little bit slower pace. But once they get there, they want it all, and they want it all quickly. So they have to have access to that Katy Trailer. They have access to the museums and shops and restaurants. And we now have a beautiful pilot house just to the south end of the bridge. And we've tried to create, you know, the kinds of experiences that they can do in a time frame that works for them. So Herman is very blessed with a lot of visitors, and our visitor count is going up every year.
You've seen a lot of that change, haven't you, Dan?
Yes. Yeah. Certainly, the Missouri wine industry has just boomed in the last 30 or 40 years, and We think that wineries and farmers generally are good stewards of the land, and then they appreciate the value of open space and countryside. So we don't think that's at all incompatible with conservation and the environment.
And yet, go ahead, Patty.
Well, in fact, you know, tourism, nature tourism, is one of the highest grossing economic activities in the United States. It's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that over $120 billion a year is spent on wildlife watching and wildlife involvement. And that's huge. And so these kinds of activities along the Missouri River help to benefit the state and all the communities along the Missouri River.
It's very apparent in looking at the book, and again, the photographs and the artwork is just wonderful. The wide variety of wildlife that can be found, I mean, it's just, I was sort of astonished by all that I saw there.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we have birds alone. I mean, it's a migratory flyway. And so we see so many birds along both the Missouri and the Mississippi rivers, and people travel to come see birds, as I'm sure Terry has seen too. You probably have bird watchers come to your site.
Absolutely.
And it's just a spectacular sight, and this is one of the best times of the year to see some of the migratory action.
And you've got some special visitors that are going to be showing up soon.
Yeah, we have at the Confluence area. Well, we're at the Riverlands Migratory Bird Sanctuary, and we have these beautiful birds that come every year now called trumpeter swans. And every year, the last weekend in October since 1991, they've been showing up. So they should start arriving next week, hopefully, knock on wood.
So folks, get some gas in that gas tank of your car and get ready to move to the west. We have to take a break now. We'll do that. And I'm talking with Dan Burkhart, the editor of the Missouri River Country, 100 miles of stories and scenery from Herman to the Confluence. We're talking about the Missouri River, folks, in particular about the 100 miles or so just west of St. Louis. Also with me in studio is Patty Hagen, director of the Audubon Center at Riverlands, and Terry Hammer, owner of Herman Hill Bed and Breakfast. Thank you so much for that, and looking for a full slate of tourists coming by soon. Back in just a moment, we'll continue our conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with regard to Missouri Country. That's the Missouri River Country, which is the name of a new book. It's a coffee table book, and it's a beautiful piece of work. The title is Missouri River Country, 100 Miles of Stories and Scenery from Herman to The Confluence. My guests in studio are Dan Burkhart, editor of this book, Patty Hagen, director of the Audubon Center at Riverlands, and Terry Hammer, the owner of Herman Hill Bed and Breakfast. You have more than 60 contributors to the book, Dan. Tell me about collecting some of these folks to write for you. I mean, it's quite a diverse group, including our two U.S. senators and our governor and a few other politicians, mm-hmm. but a lot of just plain folks who love the river.
That was the idea, to get a lot of voices to talk about these stories. And we came up with 21 stories that we thought would be interesting for people to read about things that happened from Herman to the Confluence. And so, frankly, the stories were the easy part. Finding the storytellers was what took some time. Mm-hmm. And I started calling people that I knew were interested and had a love for this area. And what we wanted really were people that loved the area, not necessarily the biggest academic experts, the greatest historians, but people that lived it and loved it. And so the Terry and Patty that are here today certainly fit that bill. And we found about 60 others that did as well. And people told me that this is going to be impossible to get manuscripts out of 60 people. But we found that when you ask people to write about things they love, they actually do it. And so we came up with some great contributors.
And how long did it take you to put it all together?
About a year and a half.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's a big project.
That it was, but it was, again, full of fun and enjoyment, and working with the people involved was a great pleasure.
Oh, well, let's hear some of those stories. Patty, I'll start with you. What is your story?
Oh, well, I was honored to be asked to write about trumpeter swans, and so I did a little piece about the arrival of the trumpeter swans and what they look like, and that was a great little piece. And then I helped a little bit on the chapter on the Confluence as well, and it was just a great experience working with Dan on the book. One of the things that I think is important for people to know, though, is this is really more than a coffee table book, because it has beautiful pictures, but it really also tells a story, and it also presents some of the challenges, I think, that are facing the river, but also a lot of the great stories. So it's a really neat, holistic look at the river.
It's very manageable, too. There's a lot of text, but it's easy reads. You don't have to spend a lot of time with a lot of text.
Right, yeah. Right.
And one of the things I mentioned, Don, that Patty did that was really great was introduce us to a terrific photographer, Danny Brown, who has provided a lot of amazing bird photos in the book, including the award-winning trumpeter swan mm-hmm. photos that Patty mentioned. So that helped greatly illustrate several chapters of the book.
I can't mention enough how beautiful some of those photographs are. I mean, they're really quite stunning. Terry, how about your story?
Mine dealt with how they took a map that was done by a cartographer in Philadelphia of what they envisioned the great city of Herman would look like and imposed it on a terrain that was totally unsuitable for the map. But being frugal and proud Germans, that was what they did. And so we live today with a street pattern that's somewhat difficult to navigate. The book, I'd echo with what Patty said, too. It's almost as a travelogue for this area. It provides the readers with just almost unlimited opportunities of places to go and things to do. And you really get a sense of just how incredibly complex the people are who live on both sides of the river. And if you don't believe they're also genuine hospitality, all you have to do is travel on Highway 100 or Highway 94 or on the trail, and you'll really be able to experience why this is such a unique area.
The German settlers were caught by surprise by the terrain, were they not?
Absolutely.
They came in sight unseen, as I recall.
Absolutely.
All right. Dan, how about you? What's your favorite story and contribution?
We've got two segments on land preservation that I think are terrific. One contributed by Trudy Bush Valentine about her grandfather, August Bush, a letter he wrote to Missouri farmers in 1918 asking them to pull together for the war effort. And then she goes on to talk, of course, about the Bush Conservation Area, which is a huge gift from the Bush family, 7,000 acres out west of St. Louis along the river. That is, you know, a tremendous asset to the area. It started in 1947 and has preserved a lot of land out there. And then Shaw Nature Reserve is another example of land preservation. In the 1920s, the Missouri Botanical Garden bought that large tract of land that's become Shaw Nature Reserve because all of the plants were dying in St. Louis from coal smoke. That was the environmental problem of the day. And eventually, the coal smoke abated, and plants started to thrive at the botanical garden. But they still had 2,300 acres of beautiful countryside out there. And there's a terrific poem in the book by the first superintendent of Shaw Nature Reserve, written in 1937, that reads like it could have been written last week. He talks about the classic trade-offs between business interests and conservation and the environment, and it's a real interesting thing to read.
Is that land out there that you've just been speaking about, is that protected in perpetuity?
The Bush Conservation Area is owned by the Missouri Department of Conservation, and it I would think would be permanently protected from development. It would be quite a upsetting thing for everyone if that was ever developed. So I think both that and Shaw Nature Reserve are permanently protected.
And Patty, that's something that you would be watching very, very closely, given your interest, needless
to
say.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Did you want to add something? Mm-hmm. How do you protect that area that has not been donated and being and kept for however long? How do you protect the rest of it? How do you keep farmers from selling out to a big box store, for instance?
Well, that's one of the stories we try to tell in the book, is that there are ways that individual private landowners can protect their land from future development. There's something called a conservation easement that a private landowner can place on their land that ensures that their land will forever stay in farm or forestry use. In other parts of the country, these land trusts that place conservation easements on land are very, very well known and very successful and protect large swaths of land. With the Katy Land Trust that we started a few years ago, we're trying to do that along the Katy Trail west of St. Louis. And we've had some good success. For example, in southern Warren County, where we've been emphasizing our efforts, we've protected about 2,500 acres of land with conservation easements, and that's eight different properties. So one of the goals of the book is just to start some discussion about the value, the beauty of this land west of St. Louis, and to get people to think about voluntarily protecting their property from future development.
One of the great stories, and our time is beginning to wind down, but one of the great stories that I've heard ever since I came to Missouri, but many people may not know, is how the Missouri wine industry saved the French wine industry at one point. And Terry, maybe you're the guy to just address that. It was the Missouri grapes that saved France.
Yeah, we were very lucky to grow Norton, which is a Native American variety of grape, and the French were plagued with a root louse called phylloxera. And so literally millions of grapevines were shipped from Missouri vineyards to France, and like you graft roses with a very tenacious rootstock, they grafted the Merlots and Cabs and Pinots and all of the other French varieties to this American rootstock, which to today still is there. And they erected statues and have honored us. And then later, the similar thing happened in California. And once again, Missouri shipped rootstock to California to protect that. So it's another part of Herman's varied but very interesting history in wine production. Of course, there was a time when Missouri was number one in the nation in terms of wine production.
There was also a time, though, when Missouri wine was kind of frowned upon. Talk about playing second fiddle and being a second-class citizen. Isn't that true, Dan?
historically, Germans drank sweet wine, and so that's what a lot of the Missouri wine was. But beginning about 20 or 25 years ago, Missouri wineries started to get serious about good food wines that would pair well with foods. And there's some tremendous wines being made in Missouri, and we talk about a few of the wineries that make them in the book.
Right. Including Dan's wine.
oh, by the way.
Well, it's a great story, and I think it's one a lot of people may not know, but it's just one of the things you can learn in the book, the title of which is Missouri River Country, 100 Miles of Stories and Scenery from Herman to the Confluence. Three of the people responsible for the book have been with us in studio, and I want to thank you very much for being with us, Patty Hagen. Good to see you. Keep
nice
up the good work
nice
at the Riverlands. And Terry Hammer, thank you so much for being with us. I hope the tourists come in great numbers to Herman for you.
Thank you, Dan.
And Dan Burkhart, congratulations as the editor of the book on the job that you've done.
Thank you.
It's great talking to you, and we hope the book does very, very well. Again, I'll remind folks that it's a really, really nice job that you've done. Now, we're going to move along and talk about something quite different. That's dealing with the stigma of mental illness. It's so often, the stigma so often accompanies people who are afflicted with mental illness. We'll talk about that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.